6. Olga found it uncomfortable to be alone in the same room as Thomas Caliscan, as if she had wandered into an obscene and sticky trap. He was a very thin man with a neatly groomed sweep of collar-length silver hair brushed back from an aristocratic forehead. He favoured costumes of silk and crushed velvet with long-tailed jackets, elaborate and carefully anachronistic. He wore owlish spectacles of blue-tinted glass. He often closed his eyes while speaking, as if attending to some very distant, very quiet melody, and when he moved his body, his head seemed momentarily reluctant to follow, as if anchored to a particular point in space and time. "Do you mind if I continue playing for a moment? I find a little finger exercise focuses the mind wonderfully. They say the same thing about execution. Have a seat, Verite." Olga sat down. The chair was a chaise longue, upholstered in dimpled green velvet. She suspected it was exactly as authentic and valuable as it appeared. In front of the chaise longue was a small coffee table, upon which rested a flat, square object with an elaborate printed design on it. While Caliscan resumed his playing, Olga picked up the object, recognizing it as the cardboard, processed wood pulp sleeve for a gramophone recording. There was something inside it. She tilted the sleeve, letting the recording slip into her fingers. It was a thin black disc made of a heavy plastic-like material, engraved on both sides with a complex spiral pattern. The disc was typical of millions that had been manufactured between the ends of the 19th and 20th centuries. It was pressed from shellac, which she recalled was some kind of insect-derived resin. The spiral grooves contained encoded sounds, designed to be read by a diamond-tipped stylus, as the disc was spun at a few dozen rotations per minute. The playback caused a steady deterioration in the quality of the recording, as the stylus wore away the grooves and embedded tiny particles of grit in the disc itself. Even the original recording had been captured by a chain of analog processes, each of which introduced random structure into the sound. But it was also a true analog artifact, and therefore of immense historical value. A recording stored in the volatile memory array of a computer system could be erased or doctored in an eye blink, and the evidence trail artfully concealed. A recording like the shellac disc could be destroyed, but it could not easily be altered. Forgery was equally difficult due to the complex chemical makeup of the disc and its packaging. When such items survived to the present day, therefore, they were regarded as extremely reliable windows on the historical past, pre-nonocaust, pre-forgetting. Olga examined the label, reading that the disc contained music by the composer Mahler, Das Lied von der Erde. Olga knew very little about composers in general, and even less about Mahler in particular. All that she remembered was that he had died well before the beginning of her period of interest. Caliscan stopped playing and returned the viola and bow to their stand. He watched her studying the disc and asked, "Intrigued?" Olga put the delicate black disc back in its sleeve and returned the sleeve to the table. "Is that what you were playing?" "No, that was a little Bach, the 6th Brandenburg concerto for what it's worth. Unlike the Mahler, neither the score nor the original recording were ever lost." "This is an original recording," Olga said, fingering the record sleeve. "Isn't it?" "Yes, but until very recently none were known to have survived. Now that we have that recording, someone somewhere is trying to reverse engineer Mahler's original score. A hopeless enterprise, of course. We've more chance of unearthing an intact one." She still had that prickly sense of being tested or led into a trap. "Wait, I'm missing something. You're telling me that this piece of music was completely lost?" "Yes. And now you've found an intact recording?" "Exactly so. It's a cause for great celebration. The record you just examined was recovered from Paris only a matter of weeks ago." "I don't see how that can be," Olga said, careful not to accuse him outright of lying. "Nothing bigger than a pinhead comes out of Paris without my knowing about it. I definitely have heard if something as significant as that had been unearthed. In fact, I'd probably be the one who found it." "This is something you missed. Shall I tell you something else very interesting?" "Oh, why not? This is the original, not a copy. This is the actual artifact, exactly as it was recovered. No restorative work has taken place. That's also highly unlikely. The disc might have survived 300 or 400 years with relatively little damage, but not the packaging. Caliscan had returned to his monstrously large desk. Sitting behind it, he looked like a little boy visiting his father's office. He steepled his fingers, peering over them owlishly. "Go on. I'm listening." "Paper doesn't last, especially not the wood pulp paper they were using in that era. Ironically, the cotton pulp paper from much earlier lasts a lot better. Not as easy to bleach, but the alum they used in the wood pulp process undergoes hydrolysis and produces sulfuric acid." "Not good." "That's not all. There are metal tannins in the inks that also lead to deterioration, not to mention airborne contaminants. Then the glues dry up, the labels come off, and the sleeve begins to come apart at the seams. The dyes fade. Lacquer on the card turns brown and cracks off." Auger picked up the sleeve and examined it again, certain she must have missed something. "With the right methods, you can correct a lot of that damage. But the resultant artifacts are still incredibly fragile, far too valuable to be handled like this, and this one definitely hasn't been restored." "As I just told you." "All right. Then it must have spent 300-odd years in a vacuum chamber, or some other preserving agent. Someone must have taken deliberate steps to keep it intact." "No special measures were taken," Caliscan insisted. "As I said, it's exactly as we found it. Here's another question. If you suspected the recording was a fake, how would you prove it? A recent fake?" Auger shrugged. "There are a lot of things I could try. Chemical analysis of the shellac, for one thing. But of course I wouldn't want to touch it until we'd laser-scanned the grooves and got the whole thing on magnetic tape. Very sound methodology. What else?" "I'd run a radiocarbon analysis on the cellulose fibers in the paper." Caliscan rubbed his nose speculatively. "Tricky, for an object suspected to be only 300 or 400 years old. But doable. We've made some refinements in the calibration curves lately, and I wouldn't be trying to date it exactly, just establish that it wasn't recent." "And your anticipated conclusions?" "I try not to anticipate conclusions, but I'd put good money on the artifact being a clever hoax, no matter how watertight its provenance."
"Well, you'd be right," Caliscan said. "If you ran the usual tests, you'd conclude that the artifact must have been manufactured very recently."
Auger felt a curious sense of deflation, as if she had been excited about something without quite realizing it. "Is there a point to this, sir?"
"The point is, it still sounds like Mahler to me."
"I wouldn't know about that," Auger said.
"Do you miss music?"
"You can't miss what you've never known, sir."
"You've never known rain, either. Not real rain, falling from a real sky."
"That's different," she said, needled that he knew so much about her. "Sir, do you mind if I ask what this is all about? What are you doing here, so far from antiquities? What business do you have dragging me halfway across Tanglewood?"
"Careful, Verity."
"I have a right to know."
"You have no right to know anything. However, since I'm feeling generous, I take it you were told about the contingencies board."
"Yes. I also know there's no such thing."
"There is," Caliscan said, "and I should know. I happen to run it."
"No, sir," she said. "You run antiquities."
"That too, but my sideways promotion into antiquities was only ever a matter of expediency. 2 years ago, something dropped into our laps. A find." He paused before correcting himself. "Two finds, if you like. Both of staggering strategic value. A pair of linked discoveries that have the potential to change our entire relationship with the polities. Discoveries that could, in fact, alter our entire relationship with reality."
"I don't like slashes," Auger said, "especially after what happened in Paris."
"Don't you think we should let bygones be bygones?"
"Easy for you to say, sir. You weren't touched by A Musica. You didn't have that taken from you."
"No," Caliscan said. "The A Musica virus didn't touch me, just as it didn't touch one person in 1,000. But I lost something rather dearer to me than the mere perception of music."
"If you say so."
"I lost a brother to slashers," he said, "in the final stages of the Phobos offensive, when we were trying to retake the moon. If anyone has a right to hate them, I do."
She didn't know that Caliscan had even had a brother,
let alone that he had died in the last war. Do you hate them, sir? No. I treat them as what they are, a commodity to be exploited, as and when it suits us. But hatred? No. She decided it might be time to listen. And the connection with antiquities? A very profound one. As the nature of the second discovery became clear, we realized that we needed to work with antiquities on a more fundamental level. The simplest solution was to replace De Forest with myself, so that I had an absolute overview of all Earth-based activities. I always said it was a political appointment, but not in the way you meant it. His tinted spectacles caught the light, like two little windows into clear blue sky. Now I want to ask you about the maps. She prickled, realizing that she had been under surveillance all along. She should have known that they would keep their eye on her. Were you responsible for sending them? Were the maps some pointless test, like the Marla recording? This seemed to amuse him. They warned me about you. And what did they say? That you'd speak your mind. I already know from personal experience that you have little respect for authority. His tone softened. They also told me you have a good eye for detail. Now tell me what you made of the maps. A small inner voice told her that more depended on her answers than was immediately apparent. She felt her voice catching in her throat, her usual fluency deserting her. I only looked at one, and there was something about it that didn't make sense. Continue, Caliscan said. According to the copyright information, the map was printed over a century before the Nanocaust, yet it was in excellent condition, just like the Marla recording. Did the period of the map strike you as significant in any way? No, she said, only insofar as it just about falls within my frame of interest. Only just. Orga nodded. Yes, I'm pretty good on Paris in the void century, up to 2077. Things get a bit foggier if you go back to 1959. It's not that I don't know anything about that period, just that I'm much less familiar with it than I am with the later decades. Caliscan pushed his glasses back up the bridge of his nose. Let's say I wanted to talk to someone who was an avowed expert on precisely that period. Given your network of academic contacts, who would you suggest? Orga thought for a moment. White, she said. Susan White. I'm sure you're familiar with her work. She authored that report on the Euro-Disney excavation last year. Know her well, do you? Not especially, Orga said. We've exchanged a few messages and had the odd conversation at academic conferences. I may have refereed one of her papers. She may have refereed one of mine. You consider her a rival, don't you? We're both fighting for the same research budget. It doesn't mean I'd scratch your eyes out. Sensing that her usefulness to Caliscan was coming to an end, she said, Look, I'm sure I could put you in touch with her. Actually, we've already contacted her. Orga shrugged, her point made. Well then, what do you need me for? There's a problem with White. That's why we've come to you. What kind of problem? I can't tell you, I'm afraid. He clapped his hands together and showed her the palms. That's a matter for the other candidate. Don't feel bad about it, Orga. You were always our second choice, but as a second choice, you came very highly recommended. Caliscan dipped his head towards his desk, picked up a massive black pen and began to make an entry of some kind in a journal, the nib scratching against high-quality paper. And that's it. He looked up momentarily from his writing. Were you expecting something else? I thought... Orga stopped. You thought what? I failed, didn't I? I didn't get whatever it was you wanted me to get. Caliscan's pen halted its scratching. I'm sorry. There was something in the map I was supposed to see. Committed now, she felt a heady rush of certainty as the elusive detail she'd been missing clicked into place. Well, I did see it. I just didn't know what to make of it. Caliscan returned the pen to its inkwell. Continue. The map doesn't make any sense, even for one printed in 1959. It's more like a map of Paris from the 20s or 30s, masquerading as one from 30 years later. In what way? The street names. There's no Roosevelt, no Charles de Gaulle, no Churchill. It's as if the Second World War never took place. Caliscan closed his journal and slid it to one side. I'm very glad to hear you say that, he said. I was beginning to think that perhaps you weren't the right woman for the job after all.
What job?
Orga asked. From a desk drawer, Caliscan produced a ticket, embossed with the Art Deco flying horse of Pegasus Intersolar. I need you to go to Mars for me, he said. Some property has fallen into the wrong hands, and we'd rather like to have it back. The name of the ship was the 20th Century Limited. Orga glimpsed bits of it, never the whole thing, as she was being processed aboard, led from one pressurized embarkation point to the next. It was a huge vessel by Thresher standards, 600 or 700 meters long, but the liner was making its run to Mars at much less than normal capacity. With the increase in tensions across the system, people had cut back on unnecessary travel. So far, the hostilities had been confined to dissenting elements amongst the Slashers, but two Usni ships had already been caught in the crossfire, resulting in the loss of civilian lives. Inessential outposts had been mothballed, and a number of intersolar transit concerns had declared bankruptcy. When she had finished her drink in the observation lounge, watching Earth and Tanglewood recede, she checked the local time and made her way back to her cabin. She had opened the door and was moving to flick on the light when she realized that the light was already on and the cabin occupied. Orga flinched. For a moment she thought she had opened the wrong door, but then recognized her luggage and coat on the end of the bed. It was her room, and the two people sitting on the edge of the bed were Ringsted and Molinella, the securities board agents she had already met in Tanglewood.
"Verity, Orga?" Ringsted asked.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," she said. "Of course it's me."
"Check her out," Ringsted said.
Molinella stood up and pulled out something that looked like a pen. Before Orga could react, he had expertly pinned it against the door and was holding one of her eyes open and aiming the end of the pen into it. Intense blue-green light zapped her retina and sparked painfully across her brain.
"It's her," Molinella confirmed, releasing his hold.
"You know it's me,"
Orga said, shaking her head to clear her vision of afterimages.
"We've already met. Don't you remember?"
"Sit down," Molinella ordered. "We have a lot to get through."
"Give me a break,"
Orga snapped. "We've only just left port. We have another 5 days until we get to Mars."
5 days would barely cover it, even if we had the luxury of that much time.
Molinella fixed her with the blank expression of a tailor's dummy. As before, both agents wore suits, but this time the cut was not quite as formal. They could, Orga supposed, just about pass for a pair of slightly straight-laced Thresher newlyweds.
"But we don't have 5 days," Ringsted said. "For security reasons, we must complete your briefing today."
"Are you not staying on this ship until we reach Mars?" Orga asked.
"Yes," Ringsted said. "As Caliscan doubtless explained, the Slashers will have this ship under observation, just as they monitor all long-range Thresher traffic. We couldn't get a person on or off the 20th in mid-voyage without attracting far too much attention, and attention is the one thing we don't want right now."
"Well then, what's the hurry?"
"Is that door shut?" Ringsted asked, looking over Orga's shoulder.
"Good. Now pull up a chair. We have a lot to discuss."
"First of all, I need to show you something," Molinella said. He reached into his jacket pocket, the same place he kept the pen, and removed a matte black cylinder like a cigar holder. He unscrewed the top and slid out a hypodermic, dense with bright green fluid.
"While you were waiting for the ship," Ringsted said, "you were fed and watered in Caliscan's section of contingencies."
"I know," Orga said.
"What you don't know is that there were harmless chemical traces in your food. They've worked their way into your body and tagged themselves onto every new memory you've laid down since you became Caliscan's guest."
Molinella took up the narrative. "The agent in this syringe reacts with those tagged neural structures, dismantling them. Again, the effects won't be fatal, but you'll remember nothing that Caliscan told you, and nothing that we're about to tell you. In fact, you won't retain a single memory from this entire period. Of course, we'll only use it on you if we absolutely have to. So if I screw up, or even get on your nerves, I'll wake up with a large hole in my memory."
"Which wouldn't be much help on the eve of a tribunal," Molinella said. "But let's hope it doesn't come to that, shall we?"
"Let's,"
Orga agreed, with exaggerated pleasantness. "But you still haven't told me why I need to learn all this now."
"The reason," Molinella said patiently, "is that a day from now there will only be one person on this ship who knows anything about the contents of this briefing. And no, that doesn't mean that Agent Ringstead and I are going anywhere. He returned the syringe to its container, and the container to his pocket, patting it gently. If you see us outside this room, once this briefing is over, treat us like any other pair of passengers. There will be no point in asking us further questions. We literally won't remember you.
We'll begin with the essentials, Ringstead said. The lights, please, Agent Molinella.
Molinella stood up and dimmed the cabin lights.
This is very cozy, Orga began, but she had barely opened her mouth when patterns of light appeared on one blank wall of the cabin. She traced the rays back to a ruby-stoned ring on Molinella's finger.
The patterns of light resolved into what she presumed was the seal of the contingencies board, accompanied by a warning that the ensuing information was covered by a level of security so chillingly high that Orga had never even heard of it.
"Aren't I supposed to have signed something by now?" she asked.
Ringstead and Molinella looked at each other and laughed.
"Just watch," the woman said, "and save your questions for later."
The security seal vanished, replaced by a picture of what Orga assumed to be the Milky Way galaxy seen from above. And then a man appeared, superimposed over the image of the galaxy. He wore a mid-grey suit with red cuffs and looked very athletic, his muscles straining against the seams of the fabric. He was very handsome and self-assured, and Orga recognized him with a jolt. It was Peter.
"Hello, Verity," he said, spreading his hands in a gesture of apology and mild embarrassment. "I suspect this probably comes as something of a surprise. All I can do is apologize for the secrecy, and hope that you'll forgive me, all of us, in fact, for the necessary subterfuge." She opened her mouth to say something, but Peter raised one palm and flashed a knowing smile.
"No, don't say anything. You'll just have to listen to what I have to say and fill in the gaps yourself. I'll do my best not to leave out anything critical."
"Peter,"
she said, unable to stop herself.
"What a—"
Oblivious of her interruption, the recording continued. "Let's get the obvious stuff out of the way, shall we? Everything you think you know about me is correct. I am in the diplomatic service, and I have just returned from an extended tour of the polities, culminating with a trip into the hyperweb. That's the public story, and it's all true. But there's more to it than that. I was also functioning as an undercover agent, gathering intelligence while playing the role of a sweet-talking, airhead diplomat." He smiled again, anticipating his ex-wife's reaction to this news. "At, I should add, considerable risk to both myself and my friends amongst the slashers. Things are getting very serious out there now, and spies aren't looked upon too favourably. As it is, I've probably exhausted my usefulness. A pity, as I rather enjoyed being a spook." Peter's measured, actorly voice seemed to come from somewhere in the cabin, rather than the projector ring. "I suppose I should get to the point, though. And the point, rather predictably, is the hyperweb itself." Peter turned around and spread a hand across the face of the Milky Way, like a farmer casting seed. A bright web of lines appeared, transecting the spiral, and then the entire ensemble rotated to reveal a three-dimensional structure. "This is our best guess as to the extent of the hyperweb network as mapped by slasher explorers," he said. "It's exceedingly difficult to come up with a rendering like this. When explorers pop out of the far end of a given portal, unless they've exited near some unique, immediately recognizable landmark, like a supernova remnant or a supermassive outgassing star, there's no way for them to calculate exactly where they are in the galaxy. All they can do is fix their position using reference points, for which purpose pulsars turn out to be rather more suitable than stars."
"Who made it?" Orga muttered under her breath. "That's all we really care about."
Something twinkled in Peter's eye as he turned back to the camera. How well he knew her, she thought, even now. "The one thing we don't know is who built it. Neither do our friends in the polities. Of course, there's a great deal of guesswork, some of it rather compelling. The system is clearly of alien origin, but whoever built it, and presumably used it, doesn't seem to be around anymore." Peter, Orga could tell, was rather enjoying this. From airhead, vain diplomat, to airhead, vain spy, it really wasn't much of a leap. Then she rebuked herself for her snideness, conjecturing that Peter would almost certainly have been executed, or something worse, had his duplicity become known to his slasher hosts.
She felt a flicker of admiration, quite unlike her, and most especially so where her ex-husband was concerned.
"What we suspect is this," Peter continued. "The system is old. It's been here for hundreds of millions of years, at the very least. It may be nearly as old as the solar system. Most of the portals that the explorers have found are anchored to solid bodies, terrestrial planets, moons, large planetoids. The Sedna portal is a classic example, and as far as the Slashers know, it's the only active portal in our system." Something made the hairs on the back of her neck tingle. It was the way he said, "as far as the Slashers know."
Peter turned back to the representation of the Milky Way, stroking his chin thoughtfully. "We still have no idea how the damn thing functions. Even the Slashers are in the dark on that one, despite their best efforts to convince us otherwise. They have some theories about metric engineering, triple-bounded hypervacuum solutions to the Krasnikov equations, that kind of thing. But really, if we're all honest with ourselves, they're pissing in the wind." He tapped a finger against his upper lip. "But let's give them credit where it's due. They found a way to use it. They grafted some of their technology onto the portal mechanisms, found a way to manipulate the throat geometry so they could squeeze a ship through in more or less one piece. You have to admire them for that. Like it or not, they're way ahead of us." Peter laced his hands behind his back, standing with his legs spaced slightly apart. "Now let's talk hard numbers. How far have they reached? What have they actually found out there?"
Auger sat forward, sensing that some kind of climax was imminent.
"We still don't know exactly when they found the Sedna portal," Peter said. "Our best guess is that it was somewhere around 50 years ago, between 2210 and 2215. Since then, they've surveyed, or at least visited, somewhere in the region of 50 to 60,000 solar systems. Pretty impressive, by anyone's measure. There's just one nagging little problem. They haven't actually found anything to justify all this effort."
Auger nodded to herself. She paid scant attention to rumors about the hyperweb. But even so, one thing kept shining through. The whole affair was a bitter disappointment.
"Or at least," Peter continued, "nothing they want us to know about. It's tricky for them, really. They want access to Earth, and the only thing they can really offer us, apart from a drip feed of UR and other dangerous little toys, is permission to use the hyperweb as paying passengers. So, they try to dress up the brutal truth of what they have found out there, which is an endless catalogue of dead, uninhabitable rocks and crushing cold giants." Peter unlaced his hands from behind his back and leaned conspiratorially toward the camera. "The funny thing is, though, that even if they had found something out there, they probably wouldn't tell us that either."
"Please get on with it," Auger said, as if it would make any difference.
"The illusion," Peter said, "that the hyperweb has turned up nothing of value is maintained even in Slasher circles at surprisingly high levels of security. That's why it's been such a tough old nut to crack." Now the picture behind him changed. It zoomed in on one specific arm of the galaxy, the scene behind him punctuated by stars. Something loomed out of the darkness between them, a blue-gray world of unnatural smoothness, one crescent picked out in orange-red by an offstage sun or cluster of suns. The other limb was a frigid blue, like the color of moonlight on snow. The view zoomed towards the sphere until it was much larger than Peter. At this extreme magnification, it was possible to make out some detail on the surface of the sphere. It was nothing at all like the texturing and weathering of a planetary surface. The sphere was made up of countless neatly interlocked platelets, arranged in a pattern of mind-numbing regularity. It looked less like a planet than some crystalline molecule or virus.
"Let's bring in some scale here," Peter said.
A box surrounded the sphere. Numbers popped up on the axes, indicating that the diameter of the sphere was around 9 or 10 of whatever units of measurement were in force.
"What?"
Auger began. "These numbers are units of 1 light second, Peter said. "The sphere is nearly 10 light seconds in diameter. To put that into context, you could fit the sun into that structure and still have plenty of elbow room. You couldn't fit in the Earth as well, since the Earth's orbit around the sun is 8 light minutes wide,
or about 50 times too big to fit into the sphere. But if you put the Earth in the middle, you'd have more than enough room to include Earth's moon.
Excuse me, Auger interrupted, but was it me, or did he just call that thing a structure?
The agent ignored her, and she grudgingly returned her attention to the recording.
I suppose we shouldn't be too surprised that we've actually found something unambiguously alien, Peter said. After all, we always knew they were out there somewhere. The hyperweb is all the evidence we need of that. But to find something this huge, well, I don't think anyone was expecting that. The first big question, of course, is what the hell is it? And the second big question, what can it do for us?
The sphere shrank, receding to a dot and finally to nothing. Now the view of the galaxy returned, with the intricate ratlines of the hyperweb superimposed as glowing vectors. Now for surprise number two. The slashers have found more than one of these things. In fact, they've found around 20 of them spread throughout the galaxy.
Peter clicked his fingers and blue-gray spheres the size of golf balls dropped into place on the map.
You can't see it on this scale, so you'll have to take my word for it that none of these objects show up in any significant location other than always being within easy reach of a portal. The slashers called them ALS objects, ALS standing for Anomalous Large Structure. Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? And if they found 20 in such a short period of time, and since we know that the hyperweb is much more extensive than the mapped connections would imply, we can be sure that there must be thousands, maybe tens of thousands of these things out there.
Sitting between stars, brooding like eggs.
Peter waited a beat. Or time bombs.
The image changed again, focusing once more on a single blue-gray ALS sphere. The view had a pared-down schematic quality to it. The spherical shading faded, leaving only a ring of very thin material.
This is the cross-section, Peter said. The slashers mapped the interior using neutrino tomography. They put a 50-kilowatt neutrino laser on one ship and flew it to one side of the ALS. Another ship carried a corresponding neutrino detector, an array of ultra-stiff sapphire crystals primed to undergo lattice vibration on the arrival of a single neutrino. The transmitting ship varied the path of its beam through the ALS, while the receiver ship kept track along the predicted beam, measuring the rise and fall in neutrino flux as the beam passed through the ALS at different angles. What they found indicated a hard, thin shell of unknown composition, about 1 kilometer thick. They also detected a significant concentration of mass at the core, forming an inner sphere a few thousand kilometers in radius. In other words, planet-sized, and with exactly the density profile you'd expect for a typical large terrestrial like Venus or Earth. The rest of the sphere seems to be hard vacuum, to the limit of the neutrino sweeps.
Auger turned to Ringsted and Molinella.
This is amazing. No question. It scares me that you're even telling me this stuff. But I still don't understand what any of it has to do with me or my tribunal.
You'll see, the woman said.
Peter was still speaking, oblivious of her interruption. Based on these clues, the slashers concluded that the ALS objects were physical shells wrapped around planets. Sometimes the planets even seem to be enclosed complete with moons. It is evidence of a very advanced technology, comparable even with the hyperweb itself. But why do this? Why imprison an entire world inside a dark sphere, isolating it from the rest of the universe? Well, maybe they aren't dark inside. No one knows that for sure. And maybe they only look like prisons from the outside. The state of matter inside the shell could be something very odd indeed. Are these planets that have been quarantined because of some awful crime or biological cataclysm? Are they antimatter worlds that have somehow drifted into our galaxy and must be shielded from outside contact on their way through? Are they something worse? According to our intelligence, the slashers have no idea in spite of all their research, just a lot of guesswork.
Peter stared into the camera, his eyes gleaming, and he permitted himself the tiniest of self-satisfied smiles, the merest crinkle lifting the corners of his mouth.
Well, we think we know. You see, we found a way into one of the spheres that the slashers know nothing about. and you, Verity, are going to take a little trip inside.
7. Floyd's telephone dredged him from sleep just after 8 in the morning. It hadn't stopped raining since he had returned from Montparnasse. It lashed against the window in hard diagonal lines, the wind chivying the glass in its loose-fitting metal frame. Somewhere else in the apartment he heard Custine whistling cheerily, pottering around with washing up. Floyd grimaced. There were two things he hated early in the morning: telephone calls and excessively cheerful people. Still half-dressed from the night before, he stumbled out of bed and picked up the telephone. "Floyd," he said, his voice thick from what little sleep he had managed, "and how are you, Monsieur Blanchard?" This seemed to impress his caller. "How did you know it was me?" "Call it a hunch." "It's not too early for you, is it?" Floyd scraped grit from the corners of his eyes. "Not at all, monsieur. Been up for hours, working on the case."
"Is that so? Then perhaps you have something to tell me."
"Early days yet," Floyd said, "still collating the information we gathered last night." He stifled a yawn.
"Then I presume you have a few leads already?"
"One or two," he said. Custine bustled in, pushing a mug of black coffee into Floyd's free hand.
"Who is it?"
Custine asked in a stage whisper.
"Guess,"
Floyd mouthed back.
"And these leads?" persisted Blanchard.
"Bit too soon to say how they'll pan out." Floyd hesitated, then decided to try his luck. "Actually, I've already got a specialist working on the documents in the tin."
"A specialist? You mean someone who can read German?"
"Yes," Floyd admitted feebly. He sipped at the viciously strong coffee and willed Blanchard, and the world in general, to leave him alone until later in the day. Custine sat down on the edge of Floyd's fold-out bed, hands in his lap, his flowered apron still around his waist.
"Very well," said Blanchard. "I suppose it would be naive to expect concrete progress so soon in the investigation."
"Unwise, certainly," Floyd said.
"I'll be in touch later, then. I shall be most interested to hear what your specialist has to say about Mademoiselle White's papers."
"I'm waiting with bated breath myself."
"Good day to you, then."
Floyd heard the gratifying click as Blanchard terminated the connection. He looked at Custine. "I hope you turned up something useful last night after I left."
"Probably less than you're hoping for. How did it go with Greta?"
"Less well than I was hoping." Custine looked sympathetic. "I guess from that conversation with Blanchard that you'll be seeing her again?" "Later today." "At least one more chance, then." Custine stood up and began untying his apron. "I'm going downstairs to buy some bread. Smarten yourself up, and we can discuss our respective experiences over breakfast." "I thought you said you hadn't turned anything up."
"I'm not sure that I have. At least nothing I'd stake money on. But there was something, an observation made by Mademoiselle White's neighbor."
"What sort of observation?" Floyd asked. "I'll tell you over breakfast, and you can tell me how you got on with Greta." Floyd leafed through the morning newspaper while Custine fetched the bread. He skimmed the headlines, something about a murder on the first page, until a familiar name jumped out at him on the third page. There was a reference to Mailloul, the same inspector who had given Blanchard Floyd's name. Mailloul was a good apple in an increasingly rotten barrel who had chosen to be sidelined rather than pursue the political agenda that Chatelier was forcing upon the police. Once a rising star of the crime squad, which was how Floyd had met him, Mailloul's days of high-profile cases and headline arrests were long over. Now he was working scraps from the table, unglamorous assignments like anti-bootlegging operations. According to the article, Mailloul had uncovered an illegal record-pressing scam in the Montrouge quartier. The article described the investigation as ongoing, with the police following up a number of additional leads concerning other criminal activities taking place in the same complex of abandoned buildings. The news depressed Floyd. As glad as he was that he might now be able to scour the record markets without worrying that some apparently priceless piece of jazz history, say, a Jeanette recording of Louis Armstrong from 1923,
might actually have been pressed about a week ago. It was dispiriting to think of a good man like Mailol reduced to such meager fare when suspicious deaths were going uninvestigated. He went into the bathroom and showered in lukewarm water stained with rust from the apartment's ancient plumbing. There was a bad taste in his mouth, and it wasn't the shower water or the memory of the orange brandy he had shared with Greta. Drying himself, he heard Custine coming back into the apartment. Floyd put on a vest and braces and a clean white shirt, leaving the choice of tie until he had to face the outside world. He padded into the tiny little kitchen in his socks. A warm bread smell filled the room, and Custine was already spreading butter and jelly onto a slice.
"Here," the Frenchman said, "eat this and stop looking so miserable."
I could do without him ringing us at 8 in the morning. Floyd scraped back a seat and slumped down opposite Custine. "I'm in two minds about this whole business, Andre. I'm beginning to think we should call it off before it goes much further." Custine poured some more coffee for them both. His jacket was dark with rain, but otherwise he looked impeccably bright-eyed and well-presented, cheeks and chin clean-shaven, his mustache neatly trimmed and oiled.
"There was a time yesterday when I would have agreed with you.
And now?"
"Now I have my suspicions that there might be something to this after all. It's what that neighbor told me. Something was going on, that's for sure."
Floyd started on his bread. "So what did the neighbor have to say?" Custine tucked a napkin into his collar. "I spoke to all the tenants who were present last night. Blanchard thought they would all be home, but two were absent, or had at least left the building by the time we began our investigations. We can catch up with them later. At the very least, it'll give us another reason to drag things out."
"The neighbor," Floyd persisted.
"A young man, law student." Custine bit into his jellied bread and dabbed delicately around his mouth with the napkin.
"Helpful enough chap. In fact, they were all helpful once they realized that they weren't dealing with the quay. And a murder, well..."
He waved the bread for emphasis.
"You can't shut them up once they get it into their heads that they might be material witnesses in a murder case."
"What did the law student have to say for himself?"
"He didn't really know her at all. Said he kept very odd hours as well, and that their paths didn't cross very often. Nodding acquaintances, that sort of thing."
"Did he fancy her?"
"Fellow already has a fiancée, from what I gathered."
"It sounds as if he barely knew Susan White. What did he have on her?"
"It's what he heard," Custine said. "You know what these buildings are like, walls like rice paper. He would always know if she was home. She couldn't move around without the floorboards creaking."
"That's all?"
"No, he heard noises, strange sounds," Custine said, "like someone playing the same note very quietly on a flute or recorder, over and over again."
Floyd scratched his scalp. "Blanchard said he never heard her playing any music at all, not on the radio or on that old phonograph. But he did mention noises."
"Agreed. And you think he'd have noticed if she kept an instrument in her room, wouldn't you?"
"So it wasn't an instrument. What else could it have been?" Floyd mused.
"Whatever it was must have been coming through the wireless. The way the student described it, the notes sounded rather like code. He heard long notes and short notes, and sometimes he was aware of repetition, as if a particular message was being repeated."
For the first time that morning, Floyd felt the onset of something approaching alertness.
"Like Morse code, you mean?"
"Draw your own conclusions. Of course, the student didn't have the presence of mind actually to record any of these sounds as he heard them. It wasn't until she died that he thought anything of it, and even then he didn't attach any particular importance to it."
"No?
He's been studying for 3 years, renting almost a dozen different rooms in the process. He says he'd be hard-pressed to think of a single neighbor who didn't have at least one strange habit. After a while, he said, you learn to stop dwelling on such things. He admitted to me that he was fond of gargling mouthwash, and that at least one of his fellow tenants had commented that this was rather an odd thing to do at 2 in the morning.
Floyd finished off his bread and coffee.
"We'll need to get back into her room. Examine it thoroughly this time."
"I'm sure Blanchard will be happy to oblige if he feels it's in the interests of the case."
"Maybe." Floyd stood up, scratching his chin and making a mental note to shave before leaving the building. "But I'd prefer to keep a lid on this for now.
I don't want him getting all excited over the possibility that she might have been a spy.
Christine looked at him with a knowing twinkle in his eye. But you're considering it, aren't you? You're at least toying with the possibility?
Let's stick to concrete evidence, meaning eyewitnesses. What about the other tenants? Get anything from them?
Nothing useful. One fellow reported seeing an odd little girl hanging around the place on the day of the accident.
Odd in what way?
Said the child looked rather sickly.
Well then, Floyd said with a flourish of one hand, round up the usual sickly children, case closed.
But nagging at the back of his mind was the memory of the girl who had been coming out of Blanchard's building when they had arrived the evening before.
There couldn't really be a connection, could there?
The fellow was just trying to be helpful, Christine said defensively. At least the tenants all have your card now, and everyone I spoke to promised to get in touch if anything jogs their memories. No one knew anything about a sister. He set about buttering himself another slice of bread.
Well, that's my news. Your turn.
The Mathis slid through thick Thursday morning traffic, ankle-deep water hissing around the wheels, where the overloaded drains had backed up and overflowed onto the street. The rain had finally eased, and the sun was glinting fitfully off wet stonework and the fluted iron columns of street lamps, gleaming off statues and the Art Nouveau signs guarding the entrances to the metro. Floyd loved Paris like this. Through his blurred and slitted eyes, the city looked like an oil painting that needed a few more days to dry.
So about Greta, Christine said from the passenger seat. You can't put it off forever, Floyd. We had a deal.
What deal?
That I'd tell you about my interviews, and you'd tell me about Greta.
Floyd's knuckles tightened on the wheel. She isn't back for good. She won't be rejoining the band.
And there's no hope of talking her into it?
None at all.
Then why is she back, if it isn't to torment you with what might have been? She's cruel, our imperious little Fraulein, but she isn't that cruel.
Her aunt's dying, Floyd said. She wants to be with her until the end. That's part of it, anyway.
And the rest?
Floyd hesitated, on the verge of telling Christine to mind his own business. But Christine deserved better than that. His future was at stake here just as much as Floyd's. He just didn't realize it yet. She's not going back to the touring band, either.
Fell out with them?
Seems not. Just didn't feel they were going anywhere. And that she wouldn't be either if she stayed with them. So she got an idea into her head.
She's going solo.
Floyd shook his head. More ambitious than that. Television. He said the word like an obscenity. She wants to be part of it.
Can't blame the girl, Christine replied, shrugging. She's got the talent, and she's definitely got the looks.
Good for her, I say.
Why aren't you cheering her on?
Floyd steered the car past a hole in the road where some overall-clad workmen were swapping jokes, but showing no other sign of activity. Because she's talking about television in America, he said. In Los Angeles, of course. Christine said nothing for a few blocks. Floyd drove on in silence, half imagining that he could hear the grinding of his partner's mental gears as he worked out the implications. Finally, they slowed for a set of traffic lights.
She's asked you to go with her, hasn't she?
Christine guessed. Not exactly asked, Floyd said. More like delivered an ultimatum. If I go with her, there's a chance for us to be together. She said we could see how it works out. If I don't, she walks out of my life and I'll never hear from her again. They moved off again as the traffic light changed.
That's quite an ultimatum, Christine said. Understandable from her point of view, though. It would be useful to have a burly American boyfriend around to fend off the sharks.
I'm French.
You're French when it suits you. You pass as American just as easily when that suits you.
I can't go. I have a life here. I have a business. I have a business partner who depends on me for his livelihood.
You sound like someone trying very hard to convince himself of something.
Would you care for my opinion?
Something tells me I'm going to get it anyway.
You should go with her. Take the boat or plane or whatever to America. Look after her in Hollywood, or wherever it is that these television people have their empire. Give it 2 years. If it hasn't worked out, Greta will still be able to make a good living back here.
And me?
If she makes a good living, maybe you won't have to worry about earning one.
I don't know, Andre.
Christine thumped the dashboard in frustration. What have you got to lose?
We may have a case at this moment.
but most of the time we barely have 2 centimes to rub together. It's all excitement now. But if this murder investigation doesn't pan out, we'll be back exactly where we were this time yesterday, knocking on a lot of doors in the Marais. Except we won't have a double base. We'll always find detective work. Undoubtedly. But if there's one thing I've learned in your employment, Floyd, it's that there's only so much money to be made from tracking down mistresses and missing cats. What would you do? Floyd asked. What I have always done, Christine replied. Follow my instincts and my conscience. I'll hand the business over to you, of course, if it comes to it. Then you've at least thought things through that far. I'm glad, Floyd. It shows that you are thinking clearly for once in your life. I'm considering the options, that's all. Floyd steered the car onto the street where Blanchard lived. Nothing will happen until we solve this case. An unexpected breakthrough? Blanchard asked when he opened the door to his rooms and let them inside. So little outside light made its way into the stairwells and corridors that the atmosphere of the building had barely changed from the previous evening. Clearly a lot can change in an hour. I told you we had some leads, Floyd corrected him. In the meantime, my partner and I need to have another look in Mademoiselle White's room. Do you think you missed something significant the first time? That was a glance, not an investigation. Floyd nodded at the little briefcase Christine had brought with him. This time we're here to do a proper job. I'll show you up to the room in that case. They waited a moment for the landlord to button on a cardigan and fetch his keys. Politely, Floyd and Christine followed him as he ascended the stairs to Susan White's room on the 5th floor. Just to confirm, no one but you has touched this room until we saw it yesterday, Floyd asked. No one at all. Could anyone else have found their way in without you knowing about it? They would need a key, Blanchard said. I have Mademoiselle White's key. It was on her person when she died. The police returned it. Could someone have copied that key? Floyd persisted. Conceivably, but it's numbered for an apartment. No reputable locksmith would duplicate it without consent from a landlord. Blanchard let them into the room. In daylight, it looked larger and dustier, but otherwise was as Floyd remembered it from the evening before, crammed with books, newspapers, magazines, and records. The balcony doors had been latched open an inch to air out the place, and the filmy white drapes drawn across them were moving in the breeze. We'll need some time alone up here, Floyd said. Please don't take offense, but we tend to work best without an audience. Blanchard hovered at the door, and for a moment Floyd wondered if they were ever going to get rid of him. Very well, then, Blanchard said eventually. I shall give you some privacy. Please, leave everything as you found it. We'll do just that, Christine assured him. He waited until the door had closed behind the landlord before asking, Floyd, what exactly are we looking for? I want to know what she was listening to on the wireless. Go and check that the old man isn't still snooping around outside, will you? Christine went to the door, opened it a crack, and checked the hallway. No, I can hear him moving down the stairs. You want me to check on the neighbors as well? No need. They're probably at work. Floyd knelt down and started fiddling with the huge old wireless set. He had brought his notebook and made sure that the dial was still tuned to the same wavelength as when they had last examined it. Once again, the tuning band's pale illumination glimmered to life as the valves heated up, and there was no crackling as he turned the dial and slid the arrow along the band from station to station. But there was still no music, no voices, no code-like noises. Perhaps the neighbor was imagining it, Christine said. Blanchard also mentioned hearing noises. I don't think the two of them were imagining the same thing independently. There must be something wrong with the wireless in that case. Maybe there is. Look at this. Christine knelt down next to Floyd and followed his partner's gaze. It's a carpet, Floyd. They're a surprisingly common feature in houses. I mean the scuff marks, you idiot, Floyd said affectionately, as he indicated 2 scratches in the carpet, spaced about the width of the wireless set. I don't know if they're recent or not. I noticed them when we were here last night. The carpet was rucked up as well, but I didn't put 2 and 2 together until now. And now you're thinking... I'd say they were caused by someone dragging the wireless away from the wall. They must have been in a hurry to make such a messy job of it. My thinking exactly. Floyd patted Christine on the back. Let's have a look, shall we? Can't hurt.
Make sure the door's bolted. I don't want the old man coming back in and seeing us fiddling with the wireless. That'll really put ideas into his head.
It's secure, Christine said after checking the door. Between them, they heaved the wireless set away from the wall, taking care not to add any more scuff marks to the carpet. It was a job for two people, and Floyd didn't doubt that he would have had a difficult time of it had Christine not been there.
Look, he said, when they had the wireless a clear half meter from the wall. Three screws on the floor, and some wood shavings, suggesting that they were ripped out of the back of the wireless for some reason.
Christine peered over his shoulder, holding a handkerchief to his face against the dust.
Someone's fiddled with it, he said.
In a hurry, too.
Floyd pulled aside the thin wood backing of the wireless, which was hanging loose, attached by only one screw. It wouldn't have taken 5 minutes to unscrew the back. But whoever did this obviously didn't have time to find a screwdriver. They must have poked something into the gap and levered the backing away just enough to get at the innards.
Good thing I have a screwdriver, then, Christine said, and went to fetch his briefcase.
Christine always kept a set of locksmith's tools handy, no matter what case they were working on.
Now see if you can get that backing off, Floyd said.
Christine removed the remaining screw, and the plywood backing dropped free, revealing the guts of the wireless.
That's interesting, Floyd said.
Here, Christine said. Let's turn it to the light. I need a better look.
They angled the contraption until the open back was facing the balcony windows. A shaft of morning sunlight speared the room, crisscrossed by specks of dust, and fell upon the exposed heart of the wireless, gleaming back from a bird's nest tangle of wire, glass valves, and enameled parts. Practically the entire volume of the wooden cabinet was crammed with electrical components, arranged in a looping, knotted jumble of intestinal complexity.
That's like no wireless I've ever seen, Christine said. It looks more like some mad piece of modern art, something you'd waste good money to stand in front of, stroking her chin and looking thoughtful.
Maybe she was a spy after all, Floyd replied.
But what is this thing? What was she making?
Floyd turned off the wireless, then gingerly pushed a finger into the mess of wires, being careful not to disturb anything. Some of the wires were loose, he noticed. Their bare metal ends sparkled in the daylight, and he could see nubs of solder where they had been ripped free from the larger electrical parts.
It looks insane to me, he said, but you know more about these things than I do. Does any of this make sense to you?
That depends on what you mean by make sense, Christine replied. I recognize most of these parts, certainly. Smoothing condensers here, a pair of decoupling capacitors there, standard valve heaters over here. And this, I think, is a two-gang tuning condenser. It's all common stuff, frankly. The oddity is seeing so much of it in such a little space.
But she wouldn't have needed access to any specialist supplies. A few dozen wireless sets and she would have had everything she needed. He smiled. Apart, of course, from a degree in electrical engineering and a very steady hand with a soldering iron. Maybe neither was a problem for her. After all, if you can train a spy to learn a code, you can train them to make things. So you seriously think Susan White made this contraption?
Floyd looked at his partner. Her or one of her associates.
I see no alternative explanation.
But why did she need to make it at all? If she was a spy, couldn't she have brought her own wireless equipment with her?
This question troubled Floyd as well, but he had no satisfactory answer. She must have been worried about being discovered, he suggested. If she came into this country via official channels, she'd have had to go through customs.
But aren't spies supposed to have secret compartments in their luggage, that sort of thing?
Still, too much risk of being discovered. Better to have some kind of coded shopping list of radio parts and instructions on how to put them together.
All right. Christine stood up and leaned against the wall, one finger tapping his mustache.
There are clearly still some things we don't understand. But let's at least consider what might have happened. Susan White arrives in Paris as a foreign spy and finds a room for herself. She now needs to keep in touch with her compatriots, whoever and whatever they might be.
Or else she needs to listen in on someone else's signals, Floyd said.
Christine conceded Floyd's point by raising a finger.
That's also a possibility. Whatever the reason, she assembles this receiver, starting with a simple wireless set.
She might even have been using it when she was disturbed. The intruder killed her by throwing her over the balcony, just as Blanchard suspected. Then they noticed the wireless, or had already seen her using it. Clearly, they wanted to destroy it, but they couldn't remove it from the room without drawing attention to themselves. And perhaps they, singular or plural, had very little time before they had to leave the room. After all, there was a dead body on the pavement.
And a smashed typewriter, Floyd added.
Yes, Christine said, sounding less confident. I'm not quite sure where that fits in. Perhaps they used it to bludgeon her.
Let's just assume the killer was in a hurry for now, Floyd said.
Whoever it was had just enough time to pull the wireless away from the wall, Jimmy open the back and get their hand inside. They did what damage they could, hoping to render the wireless inoperative. Doubtless, if they'd had more time, they would have done a more thorough job of it. But as it is, it looks as if they only wrenched a few wires loose and left it at that.
Floyd pulled aside one knot of wires, wishing he had a torch.
We need to make this thing work, he said.
What we need to do, Christine said, is hand this whole matter over to the relevant authorities.
You think they'd take it any more seriously now that we have a broken wireless to show them?
Face it, Andre. It's all still circumstantial.
Delicately, Floyd picked out one of the bare-ended wires and searched for its counterpart.
If we could fix this.
We don't know whether the murderer took anything out of it.
Let's assume they were in too much of a hurry, and let's also assume they didn't want to be caught with anything on them that would link them to this room.
It's not like you to be so optimistic.
Christine frowned, moved to the door, and placed his ear against it.
Hang on, someone's coming up the stairs.
Let's get this thing back against the wall. Hurry.
Floyd held the cover loosely in place while Christine secured it with a few turns of one screw. The others would have to wait. Behind them, the door rattled as someone tried the knob.
It's Blanchard, Christine hissed.
Just a moment, monsieur, Floyd called, while the two of them inched the cumbersome wireless set back into place, scraping and rucking up the carpet in the process.
The landlord knocked loudly on the door.
Open, please.
Just a moment, Floyd repeated.
Christine moved back to the door and unlocked it, while Floyd stood in front of the wireless, doing his best to smooth the carpet back into place with the heel of his shoe.
We felt it best to lock the door, Floyd said. Didn't want any of the neighbors poking their noses in.
And? Blanchard asked, stepping into the room. Did you find anything?
We've only been here 5 minutes.
Floyd gestured at his surroundings, wishing that he had not chosen to stand so close to the wireless set.
There's a lot to work through. She was a busy little beaver, Mademoiselle White.
Blanchard observed them both through narrowed eyes.
The point is, Monsieur Floyd, that I had already deduced as much based on my own observations. It is fresh insights that I seek, not things I have already worked out for myself.
Floyd moved away from the wireless.
Actually, I need to ask you something. Did you ever see her up here with anyone else?
I never saw her with anyone else the whole time I knew her.
Never, Floyd asked.
Even when I followed her towards the metro station, I did not see the exchange take place.
Floyd remembered Blanchard telling them how he had shadowed Susan White while she struggled towards the station with a loaded case. Floyd had forgotten that detail until now. It was in his notebook, but not at the forefront of his mind. Now that he suspected that she had been in contact with fellow agents, unless, as Christine had said, she was using the wireless to intercept someone else's transmissions, he began to develop a vague idea of how she had worked. She was a foreign agent in an unfamiliar city, and for much of that time she was acting alone. Perhaps she received orders and intelligence through the modified wireless. But she could not be totally alone in Paris, or else the handover in the metro station could never have taken place. So there must be other agents out there, from the same side as her, a small, loosely organized web of them spread across Paris, who kept in contact via coded radio transmissions. And unless the radio transmissions were originating from very far away, there must be someone in the area sending those orders. Floyd felt a weird sense of vertigo, a combination of fear and thrill that he knew he would not be able to resist. It would pull him deeper, and it would do what it would with him, whether he liked it or not.
You do think she was murdered, don't you? Blanchard asked him.
I'm coming around to the idea, but I'm still not sure whether we'll ever know exactly who did it.
Have you made any more progress with the documents? Blanchard persisted.
Floyd had left a note with Greta the night before, saying that he would pay her a visit later today. There might be something in them, he said. But look, Monsieur Blanchard, if she gave you those papers for safekeeping, then she must have felt that her life was in danger.
Which is exactly what I have been saying all along.
The point is, if the murder was premeditated, then it might also have been well executed. No loose ends, nothing to lead to the killer. Don't believe those dime novel mysteries. The killer doesn't always make a mistake.
If you believe that sincerely, then we may as well conclude our contract now.
It's too early for that, Floyd said. I'm just saying that at some point we might have to give up.
Give up or retreat in the face of danger?
Christine coughed before Floyd could say anything he might regret.
We really shouldn't take any more of your time this morning, monsieur, he said smoothly. We have a lot more to do in this room, not to mention the parallel lines of inquiry we should be pursuing.
Blanchard considered this and nodded politely.
Very well. Monsieur Floyd, at least your associate still appears to consider the case solvable.
For a moment, his attention seemed drawn to the disturbed area of carpet in front of the wireless, and a flicker of comprehension troubled his face. Then he turned and left them alone.
I can't help liking the old coot, Floyd said, but I do wish he'd get out of our faces. It's his money. He just wants to make sure that it's being spent wisely.
Christine paused and dug into his toolkit again, before shaking his head. I was hoping I might have something in here I could use to splice those wires back together, but I don't. I'll need to return to the office.
You think you can fix it?
I can try. If we assume that nothing has been removed, then it's only a matter of reconnecting the broken wires.
They all look the same to me, Floyd said, peering through a narrow gap in the balcony curtain.
5 stories below, the mid-morning sun had turned the wet street into a sparkling mirror. He watched passers-by stepping between puddles, and then something caught his eye.
Of course they do, Christine said. Nevertheless, there should be a manageable number of permutations. If I haven't got anywhere by the end of this afternoon, I doubt that more time will make any difference.
Christine waited a moment.
Floyd, did you hear a word of what I just said?
Floyd turned from the window.
I'm sorry. You're thinking about Greta again, aren't you?
Actually, Floyd said, I was thinking about that little girl standing across the street.
I didn't notice any girl when we arrived.
That's because she wasn't there. But now it looks as if she's watching this room. He let the curtain slip back into place. He'd had enough of a look at the little girl to make him doubt that she was the same one they had seen coming out of Blanchard's apartment the evening before. But there was still something about the way light fell on her face that made him want to look elsewhere.
You don't seriously think a child has something to do with this murder, do you? Christine asked.
Of course not, Floyd said. They took the stairs down to the Mathis. By the time they reached the car, the watcher was gone.